Leaders are readers. After interviewing over 300 experts on my podcast, I've compiled the top 30 books written by Mindset Advantage guests. You can download the list and listen to the episodes where I interview the authors at djhillier.com/30books. You can also head over to my Instagram bio to download the free ebook right now. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Mindset Advantage podcast, a show dedicated to insightful conversations in a world full of sound bites. Hosted by fitness coach, performance optimization coach, and national speaker, DJ Hillier. These podcasts are designed to help you attack the gap from where you are now to where you want to be. The episodes take a deep dive into leadership, mindset, and fitness. Follow the show on Instagram at Mindset Advantage Podcast and subscribe to his newsletter at djhillier.com. So let's get to it.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is DJ Hillier, and you are listening to episode 358 of the Mindset Advantage Podcast. This week's episode is a special one. It's special because for the first time in 6 years, I took the Mindset Advantage Podcast mobile. This past week, Craig and I flew out to Las Vegas to sit down with one of our all-time favorite guests, Chris Voss. Chris is somebody that we both look up to, and he's been on the show 3 times now. And if you haven't listened to any of those episodes, I highly recommend going back in the archives and listening to some of those conversations because there's so much value in them. For those that are new to the show or aren't familiar with who Chris Voss is, Chris is a former FBI lead hostage negotiator who has taken his 25 years of experience in the borough to help business professionals and everyday people level up their communication, collaboration, and creativity and get more of what they want every day. Chris is also the author of Amazon best-selling book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It, which has been translated in many languages and has over 40,000 reviews on Amazon. It also happens to be one of my favorite books of all time. If you haven't read this book, I highly, highly recommend you grab a copy. Some of the topics we get into in this live conversation were what Chris loves most about his work today. How curiosity is the foundation to never or next level negotiating. Why negotiating isn't about you and it never will be. We also talked about understanding tactical empathy a little bit more. The difference between being liked and being likable and much, much more. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to leave a rating, review, and share it on your social medias. We'll also have this episode in particular up on our YouTube channel shortly. So head over to The Mindset Advantage or DJ Hillier on YouTube. Check out this episode along with a plethora of other ones that I've done over the years. All right, without further ado, let's get to one of my favorite conversations with one of my favorite all-time guests in Chris Voss. Let's go. So often we know and understand the importance of having a strong mental game, but teaching it and developing it has always been a mystery until now. My brand new book, Push the Sled, is written for athletes at any level involved in any sport to enhance their mental game. This fable takes place at a high school in Minnesota during the summer strength and conditioning program. The story includes a variety of characters who teach and learn a dozen drills to build 7 tactical skills for an elevated mindset. This book is intentionally broken down into short chapters that are jam-packed with lessons for sports and life. This style of book will keep those of you who have a TikTok attention span fully engaged. This fast-paced book features graphic illustrations that bring concepts to life, forms for reflection and self-improvement, exercises to apply the strategies presented, and also QR codes linking to videos showing elite athletes using the book's strategies. This book is an excellent resource for individual athletes, teams, or coaches who are looking to implement an off-season book club. A study guide filled with thought-provoking discussion questions is also available for organizations who invest in a box set. This book is a systematic approach to help you attack the gap from where you are now to where you want to be. If you're ready to take the first step and gain a competitive edge, Push the Sled will get you moving in the right direction. Order now on Amazon or at our website at pushthesled.com. Now, let's get to the show. Chris Voss, welcome back to the Mindset Advantage Podcast, round number three. We're excited to record this specific podcast on your turf here in Las Vegas. Thanks for taking the time to chat with Craig and I today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
You know, one of the ways I wanted to first start this conversation was you've had so much impact in the world, whether you were in the FBI or now with the Black Swan Group. I'm curious to know, what is it that you love doing right now? What really gets you excited every single day doing what you do?
What do I love? Now, where did you get that question? Where did that question come from? Somebody's doing his homework. Like continuing positive impact on the world, which is, despite what the media wants us to believe, the lamestream media, to use Trump's phrase, which I happen to agree, you know, they bring us bad news all the time. And it was like that before Trump came into office. Before he ran to president. I can remember a long time ago being at a Tony Robbins UPW, which was really cool. I've been to that twice. And he said, CNN stands for constant negative news. Like, if there isn't bad news, if we're not at each other's throats somewhere or another, then they'll, all right, so it's a one-year anniversary of something horrible, or the five-year anniversary. I mean, they're constantly keeping us stirred up. So what does that have to do with what I'm doing? The reason it never split the difference continues to sell extremely well is that people want to collaborate. The vast majority of people actually want to collaborate. They don't want to be at each other's throats. And I love the fact that that's an ongoing impact.
You had a post that came out recently that got a lot of traction, is that people are not against you, they are for themselves. And this is why curiosity, empathy, mirroring, and labeling just works like a superpower. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, everybody's sort of caught up in their own struggles. So they may be lashing out at you because you just happen to be in the way at the moment, but it's not personal. An awful lot of, you know, my echo chamber in my social media is on positive thinking, positive impact. That's the, and on my Instagram, I mean, I keep getting, whether it be, you know, spiritual stuff or whether or not it's positive thinking. And one, I can't remember somebody, the rule the other day they put up was don't take it personally, which means they're not against you, they were for themselves. You know, that they didn't mean for you to be nailing it. So that's really, and going down that rabbit hole, I'm going to ask you, ask me the question again, because I think I lost track a little bit.
Yeah, it's the superpower of
empathy.
Of
labels and mirrors. So find out what's going on in the other guy's head before you react. 2/3 of the time, what your guess is going to be wrong. And so then if your guess is correct, then you're actually dialed into the person. But labels and mirrors are trying to find out about what's in the other person's head without making them feel criticized, judged, attacked, argued with, contradicted. And most people, they need to be heard anyway. If people could just be heard. People escalate into more extreme actions because they weren't heard first. And they're not looking necessarily for agreement or sympathy. You know, compassion is separate from both of those two things. But, you know, Dwight Watson was the guy that took Washington, D.C. hostage in 2003 because he wasn't heard. He just wanted to be heard. He rolls a tractor into the middle of Washington, D.C., says he's got four bombs with him, and that he scattered four bombs around the city, principally due to his family being crushed by the tobacco settlement, the tobacco lawsuit.
Right.
And he demonstrated on the mall, the D.C. mall, previously with a permit, and nobody cared. He just wanted to be heard. And finally, how do we get him to come out? We made him feel heard. So the amount of arguments, physical confrontations, violence even, however much of it would go away by people simply being heard is enough for me, because then we can get down to the real conversation.
Yeah, the last line is really is really profound to me. It's not about you. It never was. Mm-hmm. Expand on that, Chris.
Which would principally just gets back to what people are struggling with themselves. And if you're on the other side of that, of course you're going to think it's you. You're the focus of their anger, their rage, their attack, their unhappiness at the moment. So your first thought as human beings is always your defense mechanism. What did I do to cause this? And so it's really hard to not have that kick into gear because that's how we're wired. You know, nobody's kicking that into gear themselves due to bad upbringing or bad habits or anything bad in any way, shape, or form. They're doing that because we're wired as human beings to respond that way. You know, how do I get out of trouble here? What did I do to get myself into it? How do I get myself out of it? So it's kind of this crazy rage that doesn't have anything to do with personally with anybody on the other side of the table.
We're talking a little bit off air about the brand new book that my dad and I just wrote, Push the Sled, 7 Tactical Skills to Build an Elevated Mindset and Amplify Performance in Any Sport. It's a fable story, Chris, and we're putting together.
What kind of sled is that? That sled, you know, there aren't any smooth tracks on that. You know? It looks like it's a lot of work.
This is a lot of work. That's the point, right? We got it a little bit from Ben Patrick and Knees Over Toes and the importance of pushing the sled.
So yep.
There's some of that in there. You know, we're creating this framework about, you know, what are the 7 skills that it takes for an athlete to have an elevated mindset? And we came together and we truly believe that the first skill is deep curiosity is what we call it. And I've heard you a couple times talk about curiosity and empathy, tactical empathy. I think there are some correlations between the flag that we're flying and the flag that you're flying. So can you talk to me a little bit about how curiosity shows up in tactical empathy? I'd love to hear.
Well, curiosity shows up over and over in all these different places kind of as a key to life. I remember hearing, I don't remember where I heard or read it, Elon Musk said, his brother said, Elon used to read 2 books simultaneously that were vastly different, looking for principles that showed up in both books, and then it would be a universal principle of human nature. And curiosity is like that. It shows up in a lot of places over and over again. It shows up in how we teach negotiation, be deeply curious about the other side. It shows up in Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile. He says it's an attribute, an aspect of being anti-fragile. Things that gain from disorder. There's post-traumatic stress disorder, and there's post-traumatic stress gain, improvement, growth. And if you're deeply curious, trauma makes you smarter. And so you guys are talking about it with athletes, of course. It's curiosity is a universal principle of success for human beings for a whole bunch of reasons. It comes up in Man's Search for Meaning. I'm like, you have to read it. If you are into improving yourself as a human being, you read.
It's phenomenal. Yeah.
And then once you start reading, there's several books, like you can't get around not reading these books. You feel like a bozo if you don't. And I'm hearing about Man's Search for Meaning for years. And finally, I pick it up because I'm like, I can't avoid this anymore. And it's about survival in a concentration camp. And in the middle of it, the author talks about those that survive psychologically the best. They finally just let go of the horror and became deeply curious as to what the heck was going to happen next. Like it was, they couldn't psychologically cope with the horror. And so then instead of curling up in a little bitty ball and dying, then when they were like, wow, this is so astonishing, I can't wait to see what the heck is going to happen next. And those people survived. And that's curiosity showing up again as this magical characteristic of success and survival. Just survival under the worst circumstances, success under the best. So I think it's awesome that you guys picked it out because it shows up over and over and over in man's search for meaning or in just man's search for success, survival, happiness, making a difference in the world. Curiosity's got to be there.
In addition to reading, Chris, how do you, as a guy at your level, how do you continue to stay curious? What does that look like in Chris Voss's life?
Well, first of all, it's a constant battle against the survival mechanisms of being negative. because you're wired. If you're human, you're wired to be negative. Right. It's your default wiring. And if you don't deal with it every single day, then it's going to kick in and take over. I think of it as hygiene. I brushed my teeth this morning because so what's my mental hygiene? I got to do gratitude exercises. I got to put myself in a positive frame of mind. I have to constantly be reminding myself to stay in a positive. Things are happening for me, not to me. What's the difference between adventure and ordeal? Attitude, period. You go down the rabbit hole so easily. So I'm constantly working on my positive mindset because inactivity on that lapses you back into negativity. So I'm doing stuff every single day and looking for hints and signs all around me.
Yeah, we love curious. I love the quote, the Walt Whitman quote, be curious, not judgmental. It seems like when we put in curiosity, we can remove some judgment. And I can imagine there's probably been some times for you in negotiation stages where being a little curious, asking some more questions perhaps, helped you unlock a next level, if you will.
Yeah. I used to always just think in terms of, I don't know for sure where it's going to go. It's going to be one of possible five outcomes. Let's go along for the ride, see which one it is. When you get satisfied with your process, which I did, the active, we used to call it active listening. Now I think that's an inadequate explanation, description. It's at least proactive, which is vastly different from simply being active. Proactive is anticipatory. Proactive is having a pretty good idea of what are the likely things to look for in advance. You can't move till you see them, but based on the numbers, what's the most likely thing that you're going to see? So I'd start to work kidnappings, and I remember working one in the Philippines, and the embassy's like, what's going to happen here? And I go like, I don't know. You know, any one of five possible outcomes, and let's go see which one it is. But you got to free yourself up from a very specific duration. Listening to Huberman one time, some guest he had on, they were talking about how people think. And I would give it the acronym DPO, duration, path, and outcome. Where do I want to go? How long is it going to take me to get there? How am I going to get there? And to be curious is to let go of all three, which is very destabilizing because as human beings, we don't think that way. We want a goal. We want to know where we're going. We want to know how to get there, and we want to know how long it's going to take. And to be deeply curious and then to be smarter is to let go of all three of those.
There's a playful tone, I think, that comes with it too, Chris. And we've been listening to you for a long time. And it seems like when you're talking about some of your tactics, whether it's labels, mirrors, or you're telling stories, you're having fun. You're playful with it. And it seems like now more than ever, I heard you on Andrew Huberman's podcast talk about the importance of being playful with some of these tactics. Why is that so crucial for the listeners to understand that there needs to be a playful tone when you have tactical empathy?
Well, I think playfulness may possibly be another superpower. So start with the starting premise, you're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. And curiosity, by the way, is if you're actually curious, you're in a positive frame of mind. And I put that up on Instagram before and somebody came back, that's not true. I can be curious as to why you're such an idiot. You know, that's faux curiosity.
In a playful tone, of
course. Yeah, no. So, but playfulness, I'm smarter if I'm playful. It's energizing. I'm smarter. I got more energy. Then it's contagious. So you're going to be smarter. You're going to have more energy. If I'm playful, you're also not going to perceive me as a threat. So Derek Gaunt, again, one of our top coach, head of our coaching, he always preaches, remove yourself as a threat. As long as you're a threat, you're not going to have a positive outcome in a negotiation. Maybe at best it might be a draw. But remove yourself as a threat. So if I'm playful, I'm not threatening. And as soon as you think I'm not threatening, then you're going to get pulled out of it. And you're not going to think that I'm trying to manipulate you by telling you stupid jokes. It's not annoying. And I'll be able to hear it creep into your voice. And some of the funniest outcomes I've gotten lately, even when I was really tired, was when I just was in a good mood and I decided to be playful. I think you guys have heard the story where I found my suitcase.
Yeah, I want to hear that. I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
All right. So fly back home to the home airport, exhausted, and my suitcase doesn't come out of the carousel. One of two come out. and it's a direct flight. So it's got to be in the airport someplace. And I wait and I wait and I wait, and this other poor schmuck is over there waiting too. And so I walk into the, you know, luggage services, and this is a tough place to work because everybody comes in as mad as hell and they're mad at them. And so it's, they're battered children in there. Like they're, nobody comes through that door to say, hey, you guys are doing a great job. So, and then of course I walk in the door. How may I help you? Well, this is a lost luggage office. They're kind of only one thing, one reason for me to walk in this door. In point of fact, they're probably taught to say that, and simultaneously, it's a really stupid question. And since I'm playful, I know that in the back of their mind, they're thinking, these morons think we got magic wands. And so I go, I need you to wave a magic wand. And she's like, you know, her mood changes immediately. And I'm keeping this playful tone of voice. Let me see your tags. She says, it says it's here. I'm like, okay. I've been standing out there for a while. It ain't there. She says, come on. And she comes around from behind the counter. I have never seen anybody do that before, ever. And she heads for the luggage carousel. She says, what's it look like? What's the chance somebody else walked off with it? I say, it's this suitcase's big brother. And I got these great big white duct tape stripes on my luggage with Voss and big letters. Like, you ain't never taken this by accident. Because if you do, I'm going to see you walking away with it, and I'm going to yell at you. It's too obvious. So she says, okay. She climbs up on a carousel, which by this time has stopped, and she walks over to the ramp that the suitcases come out of, and she goes down the ramp, and she parts the little plastic curtains and looks around inside. Like, I can't believe that she's doing this. And she comes walking back up, and she says, wait here. And then she heads the other direction and disappears. And I'm standing there, and me and this other poor schmuck standing there too. And then pretty soon the luggage carousel starts up, and my bag pops out, and so does his. And I'm thinking, like, holy cow. And I want to hang around. I want to say thank you. And she doesn't come out. And so there's another young lady there. And I go, you know, please tell her thank you for me. And as I walk past the door that she disappeared in, she pops out. She walks up. She gives me a high five. She says, how's that for waving a magic wand? So, you know, we're both happy as clams. So now the postscript of that, I'm in JFK probably about a month or so after I put the video out. And I'm struggling with my bag at the luggage carousel there, and I've got it, but, you know, I'm fighting off the other bags, trying to pull it off, and a guy walks by me, and he goes, bet you wish you had a magic wand right now. And he got me out of the bad mood. And I'm thinking, like, you know, first world problem.
Well, didn't you also, through a kind of a playful spirit, talk down a medical bill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm getting ready to pay, and I pay my bills. I mean, I'm not, I pay my bills. I figure you give me the service that I asked for. What you agreed to charge up front was fair. So, and I'd overlooked it, and, you know, it was probably about 60 days old. So I call him up, and I call with the intention of giving my credit card payment in full, but it's about 10:30 in the morning, and I, you know, just polished off another cup of coffee. I'm kind of upbeat and I'm happy. And I'm like, yeah, let me play with this a little bit, see what happens. And because I figure, you know, there's 10% discounts, a throwaway. Like, unless you're the worst person in the world. And actually, most of the worst people in the world get 10% discounts just to make them go away. Somebody's tired of being yelled at. So 10% ground ball. And get the phone tree. And finally, you know, if you owe us money, and young lady on the other end just goes, hello. And I'm, of course, because they're in debt collection and they got nothing but whining, complaining people,
right,
trying to, you know, this is unfair, wah, all the complaints. They've heard them. So, hello. And so I go, I owe you money. And I can hear a change, because what's she going to say? You know, what are they thinking in their head? Like in the luggage place, they're thinking, like, these idiots think we got magic wands. Right. So she's going to be thinking, you owe us money. You got no excuses. And she goes, let me check. And I give her the number. She goes, oh, yes, you do. And if you're in debt collection, at some point in time, you've sent the sheriffs to somebody's house to put them out or to take their stuff. So I go, I got to pay this for you guys come to my house and drag me out of here. And of course she's been through that. She goes, oh yeah, well, we will do that. But now she's laughing with me and she's joking. And I asked for the discount. You know, if I pay this in full right now, what kind of a discount can I get? She says $700. And it's about a $3,000 bill, MRI, you know, legitimate bill. And I think, wow, you know, I was hoping for 10%. This looks like 20, roughly. A 20-minute phone call. So, you know, I hear her say it in the background. She's got to check. The person you're talking to has got to check with the boss. And how are they going to pitch it? Like you're a jerk? Or like, you know, it's a pretty nice guy. You know, why don't we cut him a break? I don't want to pay the annoyance tax. So she turns around. She says, $700. And I go, $700 off? And she goes, no, $700, settle the whole thing. I'm like, woo, woo-hoo, woo. And she also had the opportunity, you know, to when I said 700 off, they could have gone for the lower. She could have gone for the lower number easily. Right. But instead, no, $700 for the whole thing. So I'm like, I pay that baby right away. Give people a chance is what, and as you said earlier, it you know, they're not against you. It's not personal. So give them a chance to come out of the negative shell that they're in because they're human. And then maybe the nature of the day. And then maybe the nature of what they're trying to do for a living. You're in debt collection. You got a lot of people whining and complaining about legitimate bills.
For those who are not familiar, you talk about three different ways that people kind of approach things as an analyst, an accommodator, and an assertive.
Right.
And just if they're not familiar at all, analyst is real dot the I's, cross the T's, accommodators. We kind of want to be friends. And the assertive's in your face. So with that.
That's hard.
Seems harsh. It's like
I'm an assertive. I don't think I'm
face for the brick.
I'm the nicest guy I know.
I know. So my question is playfulness.
How dare you?
I didn't say you.
Accusation audit. That's what that was.
Well, I'm being a little assertive too. Like I'm in a meeting.
I was just being a general.
But I can tell you this story. I'm in a meeting a really successful entrepreneur a couple weeks ago, and there's we talk about the three types. And there's a woman in there, like she's dead assertive, like, and everybody in the room knows it. And she's sitting right next to me. She goes, which type do you think I am? Because she's trying to, and everybody in the room goes assertive. And you could tell she thinks she's an accommodator because she's happy and bubbly, you know, wants to be friendly. And everybody's going like, yeah, sure you are. So a little bit later, it's a closed group of entrepreneurs. So they talk about the possibility of, you know, the way guys joke with each other and they get a little harsh sometimes. And she goes, I got three brothers. You're never going to be too harsh for me. And everybody goes like, yeah, you're an accommodator. She's arguing with us over who's toughest in the room.
Right.
Yeah, you're sugar and spice. You're all sugar, right?
So does playfulness, is that perceived differently by each of those three approaches?
That is a great question. All right, so let me see if I can break it down like this. Perceived is going to be how you're going to analyze it, something. So the playfulness begins to react in their brain before they can think about it. A neuroscience reaction. If I'm triggering neurochemicals in your brain. So now you can fight the fact that I've triggered them. Hmm. Like if we pass each other in the street, if I smile, your smile response is not a choice. There was a neurochemical reaction that got started in your brain. Now, you could fight it. And when I illustrate this, when we're doing our training, I'll smile at people and I'll look at somebody and they'll be like, you can't make me smile, you can't. They're fighting it. So the playfulness is going to trigger a neurochemical reaction. Now, what they do with that reaction after the fact, they might fight it. Sometimes people are in a really bad mood and I'll have to hit them with it three times. And each time I hit them with a playful tone of voice, positive, I'll see a little bit of the anger melt. And if I stay with it, then I'll see him come out of it. So their nature might fight it. Mm. Their type might fight it. But because they're human, it's going to get started.
I got a friend of mine. When we go out to eat, we're both speakers, and it's who can make the waiter or waitress laugh the most.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just the game that we play.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how many times we get a free dessert. We're not asking for it, but there's this fun banter, but he just has the ability to bring it out. And then people are like, well, I'm going to do something special for these people.
Yeah, that's cool, right? Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you guys are doing basically is simply trying to make a deposit in the karma bank of the universe. So they give you nothing, but you left them happier. So it's going to manifest itself in other ways. So you guys are having fun, and every now and then you get a nice bonus out of it.
We've had situations. We walk out, and we'll get a hug from the waitress.
Nice. Yeah. That's cool.
Another topic we wanted to get into today, Chris, was the idea of difficult conversations and dealing with difficult people in difficult conversations. I think
right.
It's a topic, Chris, that doesn't get talked about enough. And so I'd love to just paint the picture a little bit. Let's go broad first, and then we'll get more narrow. What are some of the things that people should know, my listeners should know about either dealing with difficult people or difficult situations? Then we'll get more narrow kind of as we go.
Well, how often does it reoccur with the same person? If it reoccurs a lot, then you should question whether or not there's alignment between the two of you. And if they're difficult for you, you're difficult for them. So your collaboration is not helping each other to thrive. Give some serious consideration to both sides moving on. And you're both probably better off. So how often is it a recurring conversation to start with? Now, if you haven't noticed it before, it's always worth trying to make better the first time. The third or fourth time, you need to think about moving on because you're holding each other back. And that's a really harsh reality. And the people that are happiest and most successful in life are coming to it eventually one way or the other. You're not helping someone that you're difficult for. And you're standing in the way of them finding the person they should be interacting with. So it's very much a two-way street. Now, first time through, maybe they're having a bad day, or maybe there's a mismatch in a moment, and not a mismatch in core values. If it's a difficult conversation because there's a mismatch in core values, then the two of you need to move on. But if it's a mismatch in a moment, now what can you use the negotiation skills to smooth things out? Mm-hmm. The first move really is usually the late night FM DJ voice. Because that triggers a neurochemical reaction that calms both of you down. I will often use the late night FM DJ voice as much to calm myself down when I'm getting triggered as it is to calm the other person down. So now can we break it down? And do we have to solve it in the moment? Time to think. Give me some time to think. I heard Barbara Corcoran talking on we were sharing a room on Clubhouse probably about 3 years ago. And she said, here's the one phrase that I've never, ever, ever regretted saying. Give me some time to think about it. And I thought, wow. For somebody as experienced, as smart as Barbara Corcoran is, any phrase that she says, I've never regretted saying, I couldn't wait to hear what she was going to say. Like, what in the world is this? Give me some time to think about it. So, ideally, difficult conversation, 24 hours to process, or maybe 72. This idea that we got to solve it now, I don't think that's great advice. Maybe you're tired. Maybe there have been other impacts. Give the other person an opportunity to be heard, and your response can always come later. And maybe there's some more data coming at you over the next 24, 48, 72 hours that's going to inform your thinking, make you smarter. Because if you're upset in a moment, so are they. And if you're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind, then by definition, when you're in a negative frame of mind, you're dumber, and so are they. And the other thing about being dumber when you're angry is you're even more convinced that you're right. So you're stupid and you're self-righteous. Those are bad combinations, which is another reason why you want to give yourself some time. How do you buy that time in a moment? Do your best to hear the other person out. Do your best to, you know, don't argue, don't explain, don't contradict. That's why, how people make it worse. And it's a struggle to hear somebody out. And maybe you just need to ask for a timeout in the moment. Then you give it some thought. You're going to come back at the conversation, ideally, after at least 24 hours have gone by. And then make the other person feel hurt. Think about what you did to contribute negatively to the conversation. Because if you start leading with how you may have made it worse, they're a little more relaxed about potentially admitting how they made it worse. So how do you get there quickest? You know, do what you can to accurately be critical of yourself. I was in a bad mood. I was short-tempered. I used a bad tone of voice. You made some sort of contribution negatively along the way. And a friend of mine with the NYPD, Tommy Corrigan, great detective, now deceased, wonderful human being. We got into a lot of confrontations in New York City. We're on the Joint Terrorist Task Force. We were mavericks. We were doing stuff that nobody else was doing. And if we had to settle something, Tommy'd usually go on our behalf. And Tommy's first thing out of his mouth was always, "How have I wronged you?" And ideally, the other person would say it. But also, if they didn't say anything, now I gave you the chance to go first. Tommy gave you the chance to go first. Then if I haven't wronged you in any way and you've wronged me, then it's okay for me to talk about it. Now, people almost never tell you how they feel you wronged them. But it shows that you're open to the conversation. And then by definition, it's collaborative.
What are your thoughts, Chris, on starting some of these difficult conversations? Sometimes I think in my own personal life, it's kind of just getting it started. Sometimes is the most difficult part of a difficult conversation. Do you think there's value in just putting it on the table? Hey, I got something that's going to be a little difficult for me to get out, and then start whatever you're going to say after that. Is there something to say about putting it out there first? Letting it sit that way. Hey, this is going to be a little uncomfortable for me. This might be a difficult conversation. Kind of setting the table.
Well, I like the idea of setting the table. Now that's not a bad way. If I got to roll with that up front, I'm probably going to say what I'm getting ready to say is you're going to find offensive. You know, it's a version of the accusations audit. How's the other side going to react? Going to be offensive. Going to be self-centered. Selfish. Whatever. As soon as you can start proactively labeling the negatives. You're not going to like what I have to say in any way, shape, or form. A funny thing in my company is, especially when we're bringing new people on, first skill they learn is no oriented questions. Now, bad time to talk. The second, and they learn it really fast because it accelerates their personal life. They got this new toy. Things are going better for them. And then the next thing they do is setting the table for a negative conversation, which is for us is an accusations audit. And, you know, you're going to hate me for saying this. And I see them pick that up right away. And what's good about that? Because they try it in their personal lives and suddenly the massive amounts of the friction goes out of their personal life. So setting the table, as you describe, one way or the other, is a great way to get started.
What about when it's a quick confrontation? I just love the story where you and I think it was Wendy were out to dinner and apparently you were in somebody's parking spot and it was like this quick confrontation. You want to share that?
Yeah, well, that guy really annoyed me. But fortunately, I sort of kept my head about me. I'm an assertive, the vast majority of things that I see, I take as challenges. And that was another one of Huberman's podcasts I'm listening to, because he said of the neurochemicals, I think, driven by testosterone, estrogen, dopamine, or serotonin.
Right.
And those that are driven by testosterone, men and women, so it's not gender unique, we see everything as a challenge. Who do you think you're talking to? Who do you think I am anyway? All that stuff. I mean, the number of times I thought, who do you think you're talking to? I'm like, oh, that explains that. So I'm just trying to walk into this restaurant. It's a parking lot. I'm not in the street. And this guy's coming right at me, and he honks. Like, and I'm just crossing the parking lot. He's honking at me. And so I stopped dead still right in his way. And then I approach the driver's side of the car. But I'm just annoyed enough with him that I decide, I'm going to take an approach that's going to completely catch him off guard. And he's not okay. He's really rude. But as you said earlier, it's not about me. That dude's poor schmuck's having a bad day. What are you doing honking at somebody in a parking lot? And Wendy sees me walking towards him. She's worried that, she doesn't know what kind of confrontation is going to come out of my mouth. I'm just like, are you okay? Are you okay? Because I know that's going to catch him off guard. If I approach his car, he's expecting an argument. He's not expecting someone to inquire if he's okay. And enough, as I'm doing it, I realize he's not okay. Dude's having a bad day. And whatever's triggering it. So, and then plus on top, I also know that if in a position that should have been a confrontation, if I inquire about his well-being, it's also going to short circuit his brain. He's not going to know what to do. He's not going to know whether he's going right or go left or argue or what. And I watch his brain just shut down with confusion. And I take satisfaction from that.
So how did it all, did it just kind of all simmer after that? Was that enough just to reset it?
Yeah, well, he didn't know what to say. He froze. He's completely frozen. Now I'm, smugly satisfied that I've deactivated and left him completely destabilized, but also not angrier. And then I just, I turn around, I walk into the restaurant. As it turns out, he's headed for the same restaurant. It's a takeout. And he comes in the door right behind me. So had I argued with him, that argument would have spilled into the restaurant and probably both of us would have got thrown out without our food. And who knows how much worse it might have gotten, because I'm a white guy, he's a black guy, we're in LA, and there's no shortage of people looking to take sides over that kind of an argument in some of our cities. And so there have been plenty of people that would have loved to turn their cameras on and start filming the argument, and everybody for their own reason is going to wade in on different sides. And, this guy's, he strikes me based on his car and his clothing. He's a white-collar dude, and he's a regular guy who's making a pretty good living, who's having a bad day. So he comes in the restaurant behind me a little sheepishly. All the anger's gone and probably had a moment to reflect and was, I would speculate as thinking like, that probably wasn't the coolest approach to any human being on the planet. And it just, when he left and I left, for whatever reason, he was in a better, more positive frame of mind than he was when he came driving up, whatever was eating at him when he came driving up.
Your tonality played a huge role in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to give him, I'm a little confused and probably a little curious. Are you okay? You okay? Definitely trying to have my words impact principally on a tone of voice.
Because had you come out saying words, are you okay, pointing at him, that could have elevated.
Or what's your problem? I'm walking here. That line from that movie way back when. It didn't matter. It's a parking lot. Who's technically wrong or right? I don't even see this guy. It ain't like I step out in front of him on purpose. But once I'm there, I'm not moving either.
I'm just not wired that way, right? The tactical empathy is your new book that you're a huge part of. And that's just been at a core for you. So give us a little outline for someone who's not familiar with what that means, tactical empathy.
Well, empathy, to start with, let's define that. It's not sympathy or compassion. In the majority of conversations these days, it's synonymous with sympathy or agreement. And I would separate it from compassion. Empathy is a precursor to compassion. And I'm not against compassion, but to really define empathy, it's being able to articulate the other side's perspective. And it's not just understanding, because you can understand it and fail to articulate it. A lot of people think, you know, see things from the other person's point of view, then you can make a better argument.
Yeah.
So step one is to see it from their point of view, but you don't know that whether or not you've got it right unless you say it out loud. And then tactically speaking, we put tactical in front of it originally just to make it easier to embrace the concept if you think that empathy is sympathy or empathy is weakness. And it's neither. It takes a tremendous amount of strength and self-assurance to be able to state the other side's point of view without arguing it, without getting triggered by it. It's a little bit like, you know, tactical breathing for SWAT guys. You know, you can't teach a SEAL to do yoga breathing. And you say, okay, it's not yoga breathing, it's tactical breathing. They go, okay, I'll do that. Tactical. So we got to make it seem less warm and fuzzy, more operational. And then about the time we're coining the term, we, being principally my son Brandon and I, we start getting turned on to the neuroscience data, and again, that people are largely negative. And we got taught hostage negotiation to look for the presenting emotion. The presenting emotion was always negativity. We didn't realize that that's just the way that people are wired. But since the book came out, neuroscience data really started coming out about the time the book came out. And there's been a massive amount of it just in the last 5 years. And so tactically, how is neuroscience guiding us to deactivate the negative emotions that people are going to have? And it gives you, then it becomes proactive, it becomes very operational, and it becomes how their people thinking and reacting is going to be very predictable.
It's changed my life. Rather than being somebody's, as a speaker, somebody's got a problem, I got a solution.
Right.
And rather than doing that, if somebody says, you know, hey, my day sucks, and they give you the situation, instead of trying to give a solution, sometimes it's just, well, that must stink. And it's amazing how that connection starts to get them to think that you get them, but then they start looking for their own solutions.
Yeah. And so then that in and of itself, like your response is concise and goes right to the point. Now, a really bad habit that a lot of people do that doesn't do. So what's not there that's bad, which is also what makes it good. You never said, I felt the same way.
Hmm.
You know this, I do not like the feel, felt, found. I felt that way. I know how you feel. I felt that way. Here's what I found. That's not listening. It's not compassion, and it's not helpful. It's wordy. Like, there's so many mistakes to be had there. Like, who cares if you felt that way? That doesn't help me solve the problem. But you calling it out, interestingly enough, just like you did, there's a certain sort of clarity that it gives the other person. The identification of a negative emotion gives people clarity. That's a neuroscience experiment that's been shown over and over and over again. So why do you got to come out with this I feel, felt, found nonsense, which is really just a shortcut for me to give you advice? Like, I learned saying I understand is negative. So somebody taught me feel, felt, found, and I memorized that. And since it's memorized, it's got nothing to do with you, and it's still me trying to give you advice. So the concise way that you call it out is perfect.
This morning, of course, we're flying here, and I'm like, well, I'm going to start continuing to practice. And the person behind the counter took the person in front of me bag, and I mean literally launched it. And I mean, it came down hard. And I walk up, and it just this little smile, and I said, early morning. And she goes, yeah, early morning. And she smiled. And I think my kind of prediction is in her mind, she might have almost checked herself like, wait a minute here. I gotta reengage because I am in customer service. But rather than what's your problem or, you know, are you sure you're in the right position? Just something simple as early morning.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. And she did check herself, but she felt it was voluntary. And she felt good about her own reset. And it probably lasted.
And what was funny is she took my bag and gently put it on. I'm not kidding you. That's exactly how it was. Of course, that had your bourbon in it, though, too. So we wanted to make sure.
My God. Huh? Nice work.
Yeah. Show up here with a crack bottle of bourbon for Chris Voss. Yeah, that'd be real popular.
I think something else, and a part of that too, Chris, is I think the mistake people make is they want to make a connection with somebody. And that's why they say, I've been there. I felt that. Where I try to tell people, curiosity, of course, is my favorite word. Be curious. Ask a question rather than begging to try to make a connection. Oh, I know what you, I've been there before. I know what you're talking. Take away the I, like you're talking about. Don't beg to make a connection. Instead, what question can you lean on? Can you be curious a little bit longer and not jump into advice giving so fast? Your thoughts?
Or at all. Yeah. I mean, there is a portion of the people that have learned that in an attempt to make a connection. Very legitimate. Typically, as soon as we start laying out tactical empathy to them, they're like, oh, this is a better way to make a connection.
Yeah, definitely.
And so they'll move to that. Significant number of people, when we start laying out tactical empathy in a break, instead of saying, this is better, they'll, you know how I do it? I like feel, felt, found. And they're going to want to teach me. And sometimes I wonder, like, look, dude, I've been doing this for a little while. What's the chance that I haven't heard that?
Yeah.
I mean, if you were to put some context to this, there's a pretty good chance I heard of that. So you come up and you're going to tell me something. All right, you know, good luck. But I probably heard of it. Yeah.
I just want to switch over to some business questions. So if you're out, if you're selling like a commodity and it's some...
Dude, that shirt is more expensive than this whole studio, isn't it?
That's
a hell of a shirt.
Thank you.
Well done.
Yeah, thank you. I had a press just for today, as a matter of fact. He was giving me hell before and he goes, that's a lot of shirt, Dad. I'm like, well, I'm going to see Chris Voss.
Oh, yeah, all right. So you nailed him on it already.
Yeah, I did.
Huh?
I got him.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We got it together.
So... I could make a mortgage payment with that shirt.
So if you're selling something that's not this type of a shirt, it's a commodity, it's a white shirt, or it's a furnace where they're both X amount of dollars. It's the same type of features, same service. How do you, if you're selling that, how do you create the advantage in the business world where two things relatively identical and you want the business? How do you create the advantage?
Well, delivery is always what's going to make a difference. Delivery, reliability, predictability. As soon as you put some of those things in, even let's say that your delivery is going to be the exact same time frame as your competitor. Your competitor is being vague because they are scared to be specific. So as soon as you start making things predictable, a colleague of mine a long time ago said, take out the word trust and put in predictable. And you will automatically build trust. So begin to be more predictable or figure out a way so that you're early. You know, if you're going to miss your time mark, be early instead of late. And so much of life is so predictable that at some point in time, it's silly not to just re-engineer what you're talking about so that you're always early. It's silly, and people make the mistake, I'll be there in 2 minutes. Oh, really? I'm putting my watch on it, or I'll be there in a few minutes. We got GPS. You know when you're going to arrive, and you know when you're running late. So if you want to know when I'm going to show up, I'm going to send you a link to my Lyft so that it's predictable when I walk in the door. Or if my Lyft says I'm 13 minutes out, I'm going to say I'm 15 minutes. So if you're delivering a service, either be predictable or be early, because your competition will not do that. They will not want to make themselves predictable. They're going to want to be vague. Count on that. Awesome. Now I got a whole bunch of advantages here. You can be delivering the exact same service in the exact same time frame, but if you find a way to make yourself eminently predictable, you've relieved a tremendous amount of anxiety from their life, which means you're automatically more valuable.
Become an uncommon in selling commodities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I heard you in one podcast, and this has been key, and I've been sharing this actually with teenagers about the difference between being liked and likable.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's really key. Can you break that open for us?
Yeah. You can take yourself hostage by needing to be liked. If you need to be liked, there's a significant percentage of the population is going to sense that in you, and they're going to exploit you. Oh, you know, you're disappointing me. Or however they're going to disguise it. So you can't control whether or not you're liked. You can control completely whether or not you're likable. And then it increases your percentages. To be playful is to be likable. To be curious is to be likable. To even demonstrate that you're conscious of how your words are landing is to be likable. You got complete control over that. To say, look, I need some more time to think about this. That's being conscious of your reaction. It's going to increase your likability factor to some degree. And you can have all the influence in the world over that. And you have to let go whether or not they find you likable. And if you can draw that line, then your overall effectiveness in life is going to improve. Are you successful every time? No. You just need to be successful as much as possible.
The lights just go on when we have a similar conversation. So I've got 100 athletic leaders in front of me, and I'll ask them, what holds you back from being a better leader? Well, I don't want to have my teammates not like me. And we go through that conversation, Chris, about the difference between being liked and likable. I'll just toss it out. What does it mean to be likable and honest, caring, got a good sense of humor, compassionate? Do you have control in it? Yes. Can you be 100% likable yet still not be liked by some people? And then they go just like you did. Kind of a that's right moment.
Yeah.
And I tell you, on the evaluations, I get more students say, that was the key for me today because I've been holding back, fear of what other people are thinking of me.
Right.
And that was just a huge piece. So I always give you credit, but nonetheless, it's a huge piece. And in leadership, I think we want to be liked. We want to be liked. We want to be liked. But to know that you can be likable, you can control some of that, but you're not always going to be liked.
Right. You can be likable and respected. I mean, if you're breaking the world up into thirds, and it does, then there are going to be a lot of people, a third of them are going to be really worried about being liked. And a third of them are going to be really worried about being respected. And it was a significant problem that I had, that I still struggle with as a natural born assertive. Respect is dominating. You know, I don't care if you like me, you're going to respect me. And I've had to learn that I've held myself back by not being nicer, being more likable. And I look back on a lot of it. It's not that I would change anything I said, I would change the way I said it. Hmm. And that's the assertive's word about being respected.
So does that play a role? I mean, when you got somebody on the other side in a hostage negotiation, I mean, was there even a point, Chris, where the person you were talking with, they even wanted to be liked by you, the person that they're trying to negotiate with? Did you ever find that to be the case?
They usually wanted, they were more interested in advocating their position. Now, they would always, once respected, then their concern for whether or not they had a working relationship with you would always surface. And so, you know, what's their principal motivation? To be heard, to be respected. What happens after they're heard and they're respected? Now they get really collaborative.
And so when you're likable, even on the other side of the negotiation, that had to play a role in keeping the conversation going.
In a hostage negotiation, the sequence is you really need to, you can be likable later on down the line. Okay. What you want to be first is not a threat.
Okay.
And you want to be genuine. The late night FM DJ voice is the default opening voice and will stay that way until your instinct tells you that the dynamic is getting more collaborative. The opposite is true in business. You should start out with likability, and there will come a point in time when you might need the late night FM DJ voice.
I want to talk a little bit about emails, Chris. It seems like now more than ever, we're getting even more online. People want to communicate over email. You do such a great job educating people on what not to do. I think that's maybe a good place to start. What are the mistakes people are still making on emails that you would love to just be put an end to?
Principally, let me see. It's either going to be two or three things. First thing is you're trying to put too much in an email. Think of emails as playing chess. You wouldn't put seven chess moves in one email. It would reduce your effectiveness. So your email's got to put in one move. I remember reading once, if your email is over five lines, it's probably too long. That's pretty close. It's got to be concise and to the point. So now then, what's the tone of the email? The sandwich, positive, negative, positive. That's nonsense. It's better than positive, negative. Because the last impression is a lasting impression. And most people do positive, negative. Hey, you know, it's been great doing business with you. You know, I think of you as a great human being. And if you don't live up to the contract, we're going to sue you. Sincerely. So many people end negatively. You should end positively. Should be short, you should end positive. If you got bad news, don't let the bad news be a surprise. So your opener, instead of saying, look, you're a wonderful human being. I wish we could make have a great long-term relationship, which probably should be at the end. The email says, hey, look, I'm sorry. I got bad news. You're not going to like any of this. Prep them, put it in there concisely, and then put the positive but true things at the end. Most people, what you feel like saying at the beginning, as long as it's genuine, should just type it out, and they're like, oh, this is how I want to end. Cut and paste, move it to the end. And as long as it's legitimate, then that's fair. It's positive. Last impression is a lasting impression. If bad news is in the email, warn them it's coming. Put it in. Finish negatively. If I get bad news in an email, I usually always put, I'm sorry, I'm afraid, at the beginning of it. I refer to those as softeners. And typically, if I'm writing an email that's got some negativity in it, I'll type it out. I'll look at the structure. A lot of times, I naturally would start saying nice things. So I'll do a cut and paste, move it to the end. And then I'll go back and the liberal use of I'm sorry, I'm afraid in front of negatives really makes it land much better. Otherwise, the tone is going to be cold or harsh. And I'm sorry, I'm afraid has a tendency to restore more of a humanitarian tone of decency.
What are your thoughts on if you've got to deliver bad news? I think you're talking about tactical empathy, your film, and there was a little bit of a glitch. What are your thoughts on just videoing yourself and sending that video as a text?
I think that'd be fine. I mean, depending upon, as long as you're not trying to land too much. Hmm. And the advantage is going to be that you can then, you got control of the tone. You don't have a lot of control over the tone of how an email is heard when it's read.
Right.
And since I happen to be assertive, I tend to be very concise. And I was reading some emails from another colleague a couple of years ago who's very assertive. And I know he's not, but every one of his emails I read just came off to me as so cold. And I so concise. Yeah, that's going to come off as cold and blunt. And so with the video, then there's no doubt of your tone because you're controlling your tone.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Chris, we close a lot of our podcast down with asking what I call the $1 million question.
$1 million.
That's right. $1 million question goes like this. Chris, what do you know now that you wish you knew 20 years ago? What do you know now sitting here today, May 13th, that you wish you knew 20 years ago?
Man, Michael Mogill's a friend of mine. He runs Chris Video. And Michael says, if you don't think you were an idiot last year, you didn't learn enough over this year. So it wasn't even 20 years ago. Now, there's so much. For my type, I needed more gratitude. And the distance that appreciation and gratitude goes is, it's always worth way more than what it costs. And so for my mistakes, it would have been being perceived as too transactional. That's probably for me. Now, the number of things, like I think I've learned in the last month. It's hard to keep track of how stupid I was in the past. It's a long list. But I think now, if I look back on the stuff that I screwed up the most, it would have been through a lack of simple expression of gratitude. Not flowery, not over the top. You know, some people are so overly expressions of gratitude that they're going to give you diabetes. It's just so sugary sweet, and you know that it's not authentic. But I could have used more of it. It would have helped a lot.
Well, we talk about you all the time. You've been on the show several times now, but for the listeners that are new, how can they support you? How can they learn more about you? Where can I point the listeners to learn more about Chris Voss?
Well, I think we're going to give you a link to sign up for our newsletter, The Edge. And so I would highly, my request is that anybody that's interested in the newsletter is complimentary. It's concise and it's actionable. It's useful. And it's free, complimentary. And then it ends up being the gateway to everything that we do. Now, where are you in a negotiation journey? You should read the book. You should, if you want to be a better negotiator, the book and the masterclass are highly complimentary. Now, where do you go from there? Well, the newsletter ends up being sort of the gateway and the guide. So often the best next step is a newsletter. And then are you going to join a group coaching on Fireside? Or are you going to come to an in-person training? How do you figure that out? Start by subscribing to the newsletter.
Cool. Chris, thanks for the time, man. This was an absolute joy.
So you guys are a lot of fun to talk to. You guys are really a lot of fun to talk to.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.